Thanks, Anna, for explaining that to us. So this morning we're going to continue our series looking at where God enters and just exploring how God enters in terms of the margins. And that's really what this theme is going to be about. It's built around the Advent candles that we've been looking at, where we have five candles, not four, okay, because I want to avoid the references to the two Ronnies. And so we have five candles, not four candles. And each one of the candles represents a different situation where God entered in, where God entered in terms of salvation history and began to change the direction of things. Because when God comes, he changes directions. But we saw that in that powerful video that we watched. Where God enters, he begins to change directions. And we saw that the first Advent candle, it reminds us of the patriarchs, particularly of Abraham. We spoke about Abraham, but Jacob and Isaac, where God entered in and began to change our history, began to change the direction of things. We then looked at the prophets, particularly the prophet Isaiah, and how God, through the prophets, began to call for a change of direction. Then we then saw John the Baptist last week, how John, God entered through the ministry of John and called people to this radical expression of faith. And this morning we're going to consider the Virgin Mary. The phrase Virgin Mary is quite important. The tradition calls that candle Virgin Mary, not just Mary, because it's reflecting 2,000 years of church history, which has emphasized the virginity of Mary and emphasized that the mother of Jesus was the Virgin Mary, particularly picking up that theme from Isaiah. As Protestants, sermons on Mary are not usually very common. And particularly the Virgin Mary, we don't really preach that much on this stuff. And most good Protestants know what they don't believe about Mary, but very few of us actually know what we do believe about Mary. And we have we generally shy away from any kind of suggestion that she has any great significance in terms of our understanding of salvation history, or certainly the economy of God. If anything, she's a minor player. But the truth is that throughout church history, and even in Protestant tradition, there have been moments where Mary has been recognized. And I think for us, maybe we need to go back and re-examine some of the stories that we see. John Wycliffe, who is known as one of the shining lights of the Reformation. He actually was pre-Reformation. He was in the 14th century, but a very significant individual. He was the first person to translate the Bible into English. But Wycliffe said this: there is no sex or age, no rank or position of anyone in the human race which has no need to call upon the help of the Holy Virgin. So the next time somebody telling you what a good reformed individual Wycliffe is, just remind them of that. But Wycliffe was part of a group of people who were committed to the Bible, but recognized the significance and importance of Mary. And hopefully this morning as we explore this, we'll uncover some of that. In the Eastern traditions, and we saw this last week, if you go into their churches, and attend a service, you'll immediately recognize that the liturgy is very much based around the first chapters of Matthew and Luke, the story of the Nativity. And in fact, to this day, things like the Magnificat, the hymn that Mary sings, Ave Maria, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Nunc Dimittis, which is a benediction that's said. These are the hymns and the songs of Luke 1 and 2. And you'll know, if you come from a liturgical background, these are integral to the liturgy. You see, particularly in the East, because the significance of Jesus' death is only found in who he was. There were thousands of individuals who were crucified by the Romans, but Jesus' death has a significance because of who he was. And so for the East, the incarnation, the moment that God became man, is equal in status to the Passion. In fact, the Passion only derives its significance from the incarnation. And in Eastern theology, and actually in very good Protestant theology, you cannot divorce the incarnation from the passion of Jesus. The two have to be understood together. And so in the liturgy of the Eastern Church, they're very much focused on the fact that God became man. And every Sunday, they remind themselves of that. And the fact that when God became man, the direction for humanity was changed. And so the worship of the church celebrates that change in direction that was brought about by the coming of the Christ. Of course, whenever you begin to read these stories, particularly the story in Luke, you'll know that there are two accounts, one in Matthew and one in Luke, of Jesus' birth. Interestingly enough, the one in Matthew completely ignores Mary. Mary is very much a marginal character. Joseph is at the center. Whereas in Luke, Mary is at the center and Joseph is a marginal character. So it's quite significant, the difference between the two. It's also significant that Matthew is one quarter of the length of Luke, but that has no reflection that it was a man doing Matthew and a woman doing Luke. But it's interesting. The other thing that's really interesting, actually, if you read it, it's got nothing to do with the sermon, I've just got distracted. But one of the interesting things, if you read it, is that Matthew is totally nondescriptive. If you read Matthew's account, you'll discover that nobody ever talks. The only people who talk is the prophetic voice of God speaking into the situation. You know, there's no human interaction, But you turn to Luke, it's like everybody's talking to everybody, they're singing songs, they're chatting away, and it's all interaction. It's like it does feel like, is this a male-female thing going on here in terms of perspective? Anyway, but it is significant the way that these stories are told. And in Luke's gospel, Mary is set very much right at the center of things. And so because the church's liturgy was derived from the sense of the significance of God becoming man in the incarnation, and that being fundamental to our worship and an understanding of that and an understanding of the cross in the light of that, then Mary came to be very much at the center of Christian worship. And you'll know if you look at any medieval art over a 1,000-year period, if we can go to the next slide, that you'll see Mary is portrayed as very much at the center of what Christianity is about. This is one of my favorite paintings. It's a 15th century Flemish painting, and you have Mary studying her Bible as the angel Gabriel appears to her. And this was a popular theme in the 15th century, but just the understanding of Mary. It's also interesting to see that Joseph is portrayed very much as an old man. And you'll know if you read your New Testaments that a lot of the ideas that we have about Mary actually aren't found there, like the idea of the image of Mary and a donkey riding to Bethlehem. It's not there in the New Testament. And but that's an image that's very strongly there. That there's a tradition that Joseph was an old man. And the tradition goes on to suggest that all of the children that belonged to Mary and Joseph actually were not Mary's children. They were Joseph's children from either previous marriage or possibly from a sister of Mary's, Mary Cleopas. But anyway, so these portrayals and these imageries and these ideas that you find in the paintings and things, they aren't actually New Testament images. And much of what was built up in relation to Mary over that 1,000-year period actually doesn't find itself grounded in the New Testament. It came about because of another piece of literature that was written towards the end of the second century. What happened was there was like a Richard Dawkins character in the second century, a man called Celsus, and Celsus decided to write a book against Christianity. He was working for an emperor called Marcus Aurelius, and he wanted to justify the persecution and marginalization of the Christian church. And so he wrote this book called True Doctrine. We don't actually have the original document, but we have a lot of it reproduced in other writers who responded to it. And True Doctrine basically attacked Christianity. It said God could not be incarnate in Jesus because Jesus was poor, and Jesus died as a criminal executed on a cross. And it said, though this proves that this cannot be a true religion, because clearly if God did things, he wouldn't do it that way. And but then he went on to actually say, you know the story you've heard about Jesus and his birth and all that? He said, well, actually, this isn't the true story. and that Jesus actually was illegitimate because Mary slept with a Roman soldier, and he presents this alternate account of things. Now, when the church got this attack, they responded, and it's interesting the way they responded. They didn't respond with propositional apologetics, like, you know, point one, presupposition B's, right? They didn't respond like that because they lived in a culture, not unlike our culture, where narrative and story is much more important. And whether it's true story or not doesn't really matter. It's just the power of narrative. I won't make any comments on elections or politics, but narrative is very powerful. And the early church recognized this. And so what they did was they wrote a narrative all about Mary. And the narrative is called the Proto-Evangelium, which means before the Gospels, because it's the prequel to the story that you read in Matthew and Luke, because it's all about Mary. And it tells us that Mary, as a young girl, went to work in the temple, and that she sewed in the temple, and that so she was wholly pure because she was a virgin within the temple context. And it tells us the names of her parents as well. And then it tells us all about how she conceives and the scandal that this generates. And then it tells us about how she has the baby Jesus. And then it tells us how after the baby Jesus is born, the midwives go and examine Mary. And they discover that when they examine her, her hymen is still intact. And so after she's given birth to the baby, Mary is still a virgin. By the way, that's the way the phrase virgin birth comes from, the idea that she gave birth but still remained a virgin. That became a very important theological idea. And so taken from this apocryphal gospel that was written, which was very popular and was always accepted for about 1,000 years, certainly read by Christians and shaped all your Christmas cards, gives you your donkeys and oxen and all that stuff. That's where it all comes from this gospel. But more importantly, it put Mary and her virginity right at the center of the nativity story. So Mary and her virginity was what it was all about. By the 4th century and the time that the Roman Empire was becoming Christian, Mary was being held up as a model of what a true woman should be and the virtuousness of virginity. And if you wanted to be a truly virtuous woman, you would be like Mary and remain a virgin for the whole of your life. And if you weren't a true virtuous woman, well, by concession, you could marry and have kids. And that was the value system that was coming in by the 4th century. Mary's being held up right at the center of that. That lasted for almost 1,000 years. Part of the problem was because of the centrality that Mary now had in the accounts of the birth of Jesus and in the worship of the church, that in certain sectors, it was very easy, especially if you were giving up goddesses, to start to worship Mary in those places. And in the 4th century, there was a church leader, pastor in the Roman capital in Milan called Ambrose. He taught another guy called St. Augustine. And Ambrose said, was preached against this because he said, Mary was the temple of God, not the God of the temple. And therefore, he is alone is to be worshipped who is working in his temple. So what he was saying was, you cannot worship Mary. Another image that was used at that time was the idea that Mary was the Ark of the Covenant that carried the glory of God, and that the glory of God was within Mary, but she was simply the Ark that brought that. Anyway, for 1,000 years, this persisted until the Reformation, and apart from guys like Luther and Wycliffe, most of the Reformers wanted to get rid of Mary. And if you're a Scottish Presbyterian, you'll know that they did a pretty good job. And although actually there are some interesting Presbyterian churches around. If you go to the one in Kippen, you'll see that it certainly has drifted back in an interesting way if you look at the church architecture. Anyway, Mary was marginalized by Protestants. So basically, when we come to a sermon on Mary, like we are this morning, most of us sit here and think, we have to be cautious, and because we don't want to get back to any of that stuff, and Mary has to remain a marginal character. So we prefer Matthew over Luke and the account of Mary. And yet, I think Mary has a great relevance to us. And here's the thing. The relevance of Mary is actually the opposite to what we have in terms of 1,000 years of church tradition. Because actually, the essence of the story that we read in Luke is a shocking story. The point for Luke is not the virtue of Mary. It's not Mary's virginity. The point for Luke is that Mary has a baby and conceives out of wedlock. Right? Now, how that conception comes about doesn't really matter, because we think, oh, well, it makes it okay because it's virginal. It doesn't involve intercourse, so it's okay to conceive out of wedlock. But in what world is it conceivable and acceptable to conceive out of wedlock in terms of a biblical morality? Anybody think it's okay? Of course it isn't. It's outrageous. This is, and in a first century context, it's massively outrageous. We live in a 21st century context where almost 40% of all children are born out of wedlock now. So we don't get the shock value. But in a first century context, this was horrific. This was the worst thing that could happen. You would possibly get disowned. You might even get killed by your family for having a child out of wedlock. In a Jewish context, this was the most horrific thing ever. The story in Luke is actually not about Mary and Joseph traveling to Bethlehem and finding they couldn't get into the inn. That word inn doesn't mean inn. It's just a bad English translation. We'll blame Wycliffe. The word inn means upper room. What had happened was Luke is telling us that when Mary went to Bethlehem, where Joseph came from, the family said, we're not having that woman have her baby in our house. And she can go and have it in a stable because that's where she should have it. And by that was even a concession. What Luke is telling us is about the rejection and the marginalization of Mary. You know, that what is happening here. And here's the amazing thing about Mary. And this is what the story is about in Luke. It's also mentioned by Matthew, but he does it in his genealogy. What is happening is they're saying God has worked in a place that is out with the conventional boundaries of Christian morality. God has worked outside of them. You know, a lot of us, when we come to Christmas, we want everything to be perfect. So we want our families to be perfect, and if you're a Christian, you want your families to be Christian and committed. You want them all to be living decent, nice lives. You want them all to be successful. You want them all to come together on Christmas Day and us all to sit around that meal and look like the Swiss Family Robinson enjoying our Christmas together. And that's what we all want. There's nothing wrong with that aspiration, and I know we look over our shoulders and think there are some people that have that. But you know something? For most people, life is not like that. If you are like that, thank God. But for most people, and you know, our Christmases will reflect that. We'll sit around that Christmas meal, and maybe there'll be people that aren't there. Maybe our families will be broken. Maybe our kids will be struggling with issues in terms of their sexuality. Maybe they'll be living with their partners. Maybe they'll be having children at a wedlock. Maybe they won't look like the nice, pristine kind of moral examples that we all want to hold up in terms of Christmas. And you know, in church life, when we see that, the tendency is to believe that somehow we're second class, that somehow we have failed, that somehow God hasn't worked in our situation, and you know, we've blown it in some way. And maybe we have. But here's the message of Christmas, and this is what Luke is trying to get over. What Luke is saying is that it is on those margins, it is in those places, the imperfect places, that God enters. That actually it is in those places which don't conform to the nice 2.2 kids, 4 Mondale, wimpy house. The stuff that looks like the stories that we've been hearing about, and the stories that are not 1,000 miles away from our lives, that is where God enters. You see, the story of Luke, and if you read Luke 1 and 2, you'll see, it's the story of the margins, that God enters in the margins. The shepherds that come, the shepherds were socially ostracized. If you were odd and you failed all your exams, you went and became a shepherd. And yet it is the shepherds that are there paying homage to a woman who conceived out of wedlock, who can't even have the baby in the house of her husband because the family is too ashamed. And Luke is saying in this context that conforms to nothing like any other affirmation of biblical morality that you see, God enters. Matthew does it. Matthew reiterates this theme, and so we know it was in the early church, but he does it in his genealogy. In his genealogy, he references four different women on the lead-up to the story of Mary. We preached on one of them. Tamar is one of the stories. We preached on it again. But every single one of the women that are included in the genealogy are people who had sexual indiscretions in their lives. Every single one of those women. One of them, Rahab, was a prostitute. You know, and what Matthew is saying is, God worked through this line here. This is how God worked. And you see, this is the thing about Mary. Mary is not ultimately this example of this virginal, puritanical, non-sexual kind of image that's held up that every woman must aspire to if you're going to be a virtuous woman. Mary is an affirmation of the way that God enters on the margins, on the broken, on those that don't fit the normative patterns. And so Mary becomes an incredibly powerful figure because in that situation, we see that Mary responds with faith, the faith that God can be found in these unusual situations. And in our lives, and I know for some of us this might not be pertinent, but for you, if you don't feel that your life is sitting looking like the 2.2 kids and Ford Mondeo, and maybe Christmas Day is a tough day for you as you try to think about how's my Christianity being worked out in all my family relationships and their complexities, you need to have the faith of Mary that says God can enter in this situation. God can work in this stuff. Because at the heart of the incarnation and the faith that we affirm is a declaration that God works in this context. Just in the same way at the other end of the story, we affirm that God worked in the cross. So God worked in a child conceived out of wedlock and the narrative and the story that that generates for Luke. God worked in this context. The second thing that we see in terms of Mary and her relevance is her obedience. That Mary was obedient in that context. You see, one of the things that we beat ourselves up on is that we think that we have to be perfect for God. And that if we haven't managed to make everything perfect in our lives and in our families, then somehow we have failed. But you know something? God doesn't call us to have everything perfect, especially those things that we don't control, especially those things that are out with our responsibility. What God calls us to be is obedient. And you'll see in the story of Mary, you'll see it in Luke, that she says, you know, I am the handmaid of the Lord. I'm going to be obedient here. And this sounds like you're about to trash my life, God, which actually he was. And in terms of the age of Mary, she probably was certainly tradition, and those some of these earlier apocryphal gospels would put Mary age 12 to 13. So this is the story of a 12 to 13-year-old girl. And we're looking at a situation where this is kind of cataclysmic. She's about to lose her entire security, her standing, possibly her relationship. And yet she is obedient to God. In John's gospel, and you'll know if you're a good Protestant because we always quoted this verse, that the last words of Mary in John's gospel are at the wedding at Canaan where she says, do whatever he tells you to do. So, you know, that's usually our concession to Mary. Mary is the one who calls us to obedience. And we're called to be obedient. And so Mary holds up that example that even when things are falling apart, we're still called to be faithful and obedient to our God. Not to have things perfect, but to be faithful, even in those difficult and tough situations. The third thing to notice about Mary and the New Testament is that in John's gospel, we get a little indication of how this faith and obedience was understood. If you read the story of the wedding in Canaan, Jesus turns to Mary when she comes and says, they've run out of wine, Jesus, can you do something about it? And he turns and he says, woman. You ever heard that? And if you're Scottish, you'll know it's kind of entered our culture. It's kind of, if you're a Scottish bloke, you kind of, that's, you feel like your wife says, you'll often hear a Scottish guy going, woman, you know, and it's coming from there. And so I always thought that was an exclamation mark of frustration, woman. And it was actually a Catholic priest who came and helped me see this, and he said, that's not what's going on there. He said, why is he called a woman? That's got a significance, woman, woman. You see, for a theologian called Irenaeus, who was taught by someone who was directly taught by John the Apostle, so someone who was very close to this tradition, he explained what was going on in John's Gospel when Jesus was called woman. He said that just as Jesus was the second Adam, so Mary was the second Eve. And she was held up as an example of a woman who, through faith and obedience, could unknot the mess that the first Eve had generated. Irenaeus, he calls it recapitulation, and he says this: the knot of Eve's disobedience was loosened by the obedience of Mary. For what the Virgin Eve had bound fast through unbelief, this did the Virgin Mary set free through faith. Do you see what the church was affirming? They were saying, Mary is an example. Mary is an example of a woman who stays faithful and obedient in a tough situation. And through being faithful and obedient, enables God to work and brings his freeing and delivering presence into the world. As Protestants, and by the way, these are all biblical ideas, as Protestants, it is right that we acknowledge Mary and that highly significant role that she plays. But more importantly, it's important that we escape the idea of Mary as some puritanical saint and begin to understand what Mary truly was. A saint who lived in a fallen, broken world and expressed the way that God entered when things didn't always conform to the patterns that we and the way that we think they should be. A woman who demonstrates what faith and obedience can do in those tough and difficult situations. Ave Maria. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I just pray for us. And I pray especially for those of us who maybe feel failures, for those of us who maybe look at others and look at their families or their lives and just think we've somehow blown it, that somehow we're not what we should be. And Lord, I pray for those of us who think that because of this, you can't work, that you can't enter into these situations, that we can't know you working. Lord, I pray that in these situations, you would help us to understand the significance of your mother. You would help us to truly understand the significance of Mary as a saint who demonstrates the brokenness of our world and the way that you work within that brokenness, of how, even in the midst of difficult and tough and confusing situations, how faith and obedience can release your healing presence and power. Lord, I pray that this Christmas we would know something of that presence in our lives and in our families. I ask this in your name. Amen.